Hello, my name is Eva, and welcome to part 5, the concluding episode of the history of the Stockholm Bloodbath of 1520. Last time we left off on the 10th of November, 1520. The bodies of 82 people, stabbed, beheaded or hanged, had all been unceremoniously piled atop a bonfire lit in the main square of Stockholm, and they were burnt without proper burial. They had all been accused of heresy by a council of priests led by Gustav Trolle, who had seen to it that his own enemies were among those found guilty. And the newly crowned King Christian had in these same deadly proceedings seen fit to rid himself of the most vocal of the Swedish nobility, and not just the living, but the body of the long since dead Sten Sture the Younger, who had led the resistance to King Christian. His body was dug up, and it too had been thrown onto the bonfire. According to contemporary chronicles, King Christian ordered a script read out across Stockholm and Sweden's main cities, in which he justified his actions and called on his Swedish subjects to celebrate the good riddance of traitors and heretics. Unsurprisingly, King Christian's subjects saw the events of the massacre in a slightly different light. The imprisonment of Sten Sture's widow made her a heroine, and rebellions in her name were mounted even in the first weeks of the Stockholm bloodbath. It soon became apparent that the bloodbath, far from squashing all resistance, was actually uniting disparate groups in Sweden, all uniting in their hatred of King Christian. It is not for anything that King Christian was soon known as Christian Tyrant in Sweden, and that moniker persists to this day. As the news of the bloodbath reached the shores of King Christian's homeland of Denmark, the reports were met with fear rather than jubilation. The rich merchants of the Danish capital of Copenhagen were all too aware that their highly lucrative trade to southern Sweden would be disrupted by the Swedes' understandable anger. As for the Danish nobility, they had always had a somewhat testy relationship with their sovereign, who, in the years following his accession to the throne of Denmark, had attempted to curb the power of the earls, known as jarls in Denmark. King Christian's vengeful actions against the Swedish nobility only confirmed the jarl's suspicions of how far this king was willing to go to silence his opponents. And this did nothing to secure the trust of the nobility in Denmark, or indeed in Norway, a kingdom Christian also formerly ruled. By December of 1520, news of the bloodbath had spread across the central parts of Sweden and was met with revulsion and renewed resolution to fight the tyrant. Already by Christmas of 1520, hard skirmishes were being fought, won, lost, and fought again, first in the cities around Stockholm, then in the coastal areas in southern Sweden. The Swedish nobles, who had sworn fealty to King Christian on the 4th of November 1520, no longer could or would guarantee his safety, and with his own army spread thin as it battled rebellions in the east and south of Sweden, King Christian found himself in danger and travelled to the Netherlands in a bid to purchase additional mercenaries. but all the while the pot was simmering. Reports of the bloodbath had reached the northwestern region of Sweden, called Dalarna, by January of 1521, and here the people set about fighting Danish troops whenever Danish troops entered the area. In their midst walked a man whose father had been executed during the bloodbath. The executed man had been known as Erik Johansson, and his son was called Gustav Eriksson, but would be known to history as Gustav Vasa, a man who would, arguably, live to become Sweden's greatest historical hero. But that was in the future, for in January of 1521, Gustav Vasa's attempts at organizing the people of Dalarna into a regular fighting army, well, those attempts were rather unsuccessful, causing Gustav Vasa, who had been named an enemy of the crown, to flee the area and head for Norway in the hopes of rallying support for the overthrow of King Christian from the sovereign's disappointed and wary Norwegian subjects. Gustav Vasa's adventures as he travelled from Sweden to Norway were later recounted in a highly positive light by the chronicler Peder Svarts. According to this chronicler, Gustav Vasa had barely arrived in Norway before a Swedish delegation caught up with him and pleaded for his return. It seemed they regretted turning him down, and with King Christian's harrowing of northern Sweden, they now pleaded for Gustav Vasa to return and lead them in resistance to the Danish conquest. So, Gustav Vasa travelled back to Sweden, and did so partly by cross-country skiing. Incidentally, his route over snow from Sweden to Norway and back again would later form the basis of a hugely popular cross-country event named Vasaloppet, literally the Vasa Run, which is still an annual event today. Anyway, Gustav Vasa returned to a Sweden far more restless than he had left it. By strength of his pedigree, he was the son of an executed noble. Through personal charisma and through hard talk, he persuaded powerful barons in the north, southeast, and western Sweden to join their forces with his, and he successfully led this united force to their first victory against King Christian's armies in April of 1521. This emboldened other disgruntled nobles across Sweden, who not only declared open rebellion, but also, in August of 1521, sent their representatives to southeast Sweden, where they joined with hundreds of citizens in acclaiming Gustav Vasa regent of Sweden. Now, this is an extremely fast-track retelling of that momentous year of 1521, but one can only imagine the elation of the Swedes and the subsequent absolute fury of King Christian upon receiving the news that a man whom he wanted dead was now hailed regent of Sweden. According to the admittedly highly biased Swedish chronicler Olaus Petri, King Christian cried, threatened, and railed as he hastily made his way back to Scandinavia after his journey to the Low Countries. King Christian arrived in Copenhagen in early 1522. Desperately trying to win support for his battle against the Swedes, King Christian attempted to enact a series of amendments to civil laws which would have granted the commoners of Denmark a degree of freedom which they hitherto had not enjoyed. King Christian was, of course, attempting to give the commoners more freedom while they, in turn, paid more taxes so he, in turn, could wage war. No one was fooled by this, but it did rouse the ire of the Danish nobility. Ire grew to anger, grew to revolt, and King Christian was overthrown, much to his surprise, in August of 1522, and he was replaced by his uncle, known thereafter as Frederick I, or Frederik den Første in Danish. This coup d'etat had been in the making for quite some time, with the Swedish rebels' tacit approval, for Frederick seemed to back their cause. But to their dismay, Frederick I made a total about-face as soon as the Danish crown was comfortably resting on his head. Frederick might have envisioned himself doing a better job than his nephew in conquering Sweden, but following the idiom, "my enemy's enemy," the Swedes turned to that one organization which still held some dominant sway in the North Seas, that organization being the Hanseatic League. This still powerful organization had, if you might recall, always pushed themselves to the fore in the discussion of power in the Scandinavian countries, always with the goal of protecting their trading interests in the North Sea. Now they threatened King Frederick's ambitions militarily, as the League preferred an independent Sweden to the might of a united Scandinavia. If you recall back in episode 1, the Hanseatic League had always been wary of the Kalmar Union. The Danish nobility was caught between a rock and a hard stone. They had gained land in Sweden following King Christian's conquest, but they had also lost rights in Denmark under the same king's rule. They might have wanted to fight the Hanseatic League, as the League once again meddled in domestic affairs, but lacking in ships and men, the Danish nobility refrained from backing Frederick I, who could do nothing on his own. So with the threat of invasion thus eliminated, Gustav Vasa was proclaimed King of Sweden in June 1523 and immediately set about purging the Swedish Council of State of anyone deemed a little too friendly towards Denmark. Swedish Gustav Trolle, who had been the Danish king's closest ally, he had already been ousted in 1521 and looked on from his refuge in Denmark as Gustav Vasa was proclaimed king with a great deal of fear. The Stockholm bloodbath had not granted him the glory that he so coveted. So one might rightly ask, what, if anything, was gained by the Stockholm bloodbath? In 1520, resistance to the Danish conquest was at a low point in Sweden. If you remember, on the 4th of November 1520, a large swathe of the Swedish nobility swore fealty to King Christian. But the Stockholm bloodbath galvanized the opposition once more. None of those who instigated the Stockholm bloodbath would live to see their ambitions fulfilled. Gustav Tolle, for one, would meet his bloody end in 1535, as he was killed during a battle in Fyn in Denmark, in which he allegedly participated in quite bloodily. His legacy is a controversial one in Sweden, with assessment of his deeds ranging from treachery to opportunistic. Whether an outright traitor or an opportunist, he most certainly did set in motion events for which he never expressed remorse. And while he may have provided King Christian with a formal frame, the moral clay, as it were, in declaring a good portion of the Swedish nobility heretics, thereby giving King Christian a reason to enact the Stockholm bloodbath, it is worth remembering that those whom Gustav Tolle declared heretics were also his own personal enemies. As for King Christian, he was not a man overly concerned with the salvation of his fellow human beings, so he did not give the order for 90 or so Swedes to be hanged, beheaded, or stabbed out of religious fervor or consideration. He himself would later convert, then revert back and forth from the Catholic to the Protestant faith, depending on which religious camp would back him. After traveling around Europe, attempting to gain support from the Pope and in his second kingdom of Norway, King Christian would return to Denmark in order to fight for his crown. He would do so in 1532, but would again, to his inevitable surprise, be captured and imprisoned, and he would remain under guard for the rest of his life, dying in 1559. Gustav Vasa, later King Gustav, escaped the bloodbath. He was actually invited, but declined an invitation to Stockholm on that fateful day of the 7th of November, 1520. But instead of giving up, he would rise to lead an unstoppable army, and 3 years after his own father's execution, Gustav Vasa would be appointed King of Sweden. The countless roads, parks, avenues, and museums named in his honor all across Sweden are a testament to his success in commencing the work of uniting Sweden. So if the Stockholm bloodbath achieved anything, it was to solidify the Swedish position of being absolutely against the Kalmar Union, the very thing that the Stockholm bloodbath was supposed to cement. And moving forward, the Stockholm bloodbath would inform the decisions and the goals of the later Swedish kings, and it led them on a path which would see the Kingdom of Sweden rise to take its place as one of Europe's premier powers during the 17th and 18th century, with Swedish kings playing a decisive role in the Thirty Years' War. Nevertheless, the tantalizing dream of a united Scandinavia, as it had been envisioned by Margrethe I in the 14th century, drove Danish kings for the next 300 years after 1520 to continue in their pursuit of invasion of the kingdom to the north, but always with defeat. This would lead to death of kings, and for Denmark, a gradual decline in the Danish king's preeminence in regards to overall power in Scandinavia. The memory of Danish-Swedish fights for power lives on with a good-naturedly competitive spirit between Denmark and Sweden thriving to this day. It is interesting to note that in Scandinavia, it is these two countries who are each other's traditional archenemies when it comes to sport, football, soccer in particular. Yet Sweden and Denmark are also united in their historical assessment of the Stockholm bloodbath being a disastrous and defining event in both countries' histories. I hope you liked this episode, and I hope you liked this historical recounting of a very defining event in Swedish-Danish history. Until next time, I have been Eva, and thank you so much for listening.